Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. We'll just wait one more minute before we begin. In the meantime, please feel free to share this event on social media and whatever anyone else you think might be interesting joining. And we'll begin very, very shortly. Okay, I think we're actually ready to begin now. Welcome again, everyone. Quick housekeeping rules. We now have two ways to ask questions in this event. You can either raise your hand at the end of this event and you'll be allowed to speak, or submit a written question at any time using slido.com. To use Slido, go to a new browser tab and use the code R1312. That's R1312 on slido.com. The instructions for how to submit a question are in the description. Today's event is the first episode in a series by IDANS and Researcher centered on early career researchers and skill development. IDANS specializes in English editing and manuscript editing services for researchers. To keep up with any upcoming events in this series, please follow IDANS and Researcher using the Researcher app or website. Today's episode focuses on how to find the right journal to publish in and will be chaired by Gareth Dyke from IDANS. Gareth?
Everybody, how's it going, Christine? Thanks very much for the introduction and welcome everybody to this, as you mentioned, like our first in what we hope will be a long, long, long series of joint events helping young researchers, early career researchers, I should say, with some of the key issues and some of the key questions that people have. And that's why we thought we'd start with this particular discussion on identifying the right journal publishing strategy, because Christine, as you know, and as I know from my academic career, this picking a journal, selecting the right journal to publish your great research in, is probably the key step that you go through on the road to successfully publishing your work. And so in addition to Christine, who's the editor-in-chief for Research Alive, we're also extremely lucky today to be joined by Simon Lineker, who's the marketing director at Cabell's. I'll let him introduce himself, but this is a great opportunity for everybody listening to get involved and ask questions about journal selection. Simon, how are you doing today?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Would you like to just introduce yourself to our participants and say maybe a few things about Cabell's and what Cabell's does to help researchers pick journals?
Yeah, cheers. Thank you, Gareth. So I'm Simon Lineker. I work for Cabell's. I've been at Cabell's for 3 years. And before that, I was with a publisher called Emerald for 15 years. So in total, I've got nearly 20 years experience of working in academic publishing. And I've done lots of talks, a bit like this, but mostly in person back in the old days, advising early career researchers and academics and faculty members about having a publishing strategy. I think that's something we're going to talk about later, about how it's important, first and foremost, to have a strategy. In terms of Cabell's is a scholarly analytics company. And the whole idea behind Cabell's is really to support that important decision that Gareth was talking about there, making sure that when you do decide which journal to submit your article to, you're making an optimal decision. You've got as many metrics and data points and as much evidence as possible to hand to make an informed decision. So what Cabell's does is that we have a database called Journalytics, which is a database of 11,000 good recommended journals that meet a standard quality measure, all peer-reviewed. And then we've got a database of bad journals, so-called predatory journals. And unfortunately, that database is bigger because we now have 15,500 journals on that. So what we aim to do is, by collating data on the good and the bad journals, we hope to help anybody who's making that really important decision and make sure that they've got all the evidence to hand to make sure that they made the right decision and don't publish in the wrong journal.
Brilliant. And we'll come back to Cabell's and Cabell's databases in a minute. And don't forget, everybody, if you're listening to this, thank you very much for joining us. You can ask questions, as Christine was mentioning, anytime you like. And later we'll have a Q&A session, so you'll be able to unmute yourselves and get involved. So we're going to go to Christine first, because, you know, in addition to her work at Researcher, she's just finished her PhD, and that's really valuable experience, because many of our participants today will also probably be PhD students, early career researchers, selecting a journal, picking a journal for your next paper or maybe your first paper is a tricky thing to do. And I know, Christine, you've published a paper or two from your PhD. Do you want to just explain to us how you went about selecting which journal you were going to publish that paper in? Christine?
Hi, Gareth. Thank you for that. So I have got a few publications, and I've got to say that my ability to choose a journal was very poor. Even as somebody who's now completed their PhD, I would say that my skill set at selecting a journal is not what it probably should be. When I first started my PhD, I got this presentation at the beginning, and it was very kind of grand, and they told us how special we were and all that stuff you get told at the beginning of your PhD, while you still believe it. And basically, they told us, here's the really important things that you need to know. You need to know how to select a journal, and you need to know what impact factor is. And I'm now finished with my PhD, and I still don't know. So I wonder if this is an experience anybody else in the audience has had, kind of not knowing exactly how to get a publication in, even after having some experience. Diverted a little bit. So basically, I had this data, this work that I had done, and my supervisor just came to me one day, and he was like, okay, it's time to publish. And I said, really? I didn't really think that it was time to publish, but I guess it was. And then he said, so are we going to publish in this journal? And I said, okay, that sounds like a reasonable thing. And then a year went by, and I had my next data set. And once again, he came into my office and said, well, now you will publish in this journal. So I said, well, great, okay. And luckily, in both situations, what happened was that the publication got accepted, and I never had to wonder about it. And in the third case, I had basically this data, and I wanted to publish it. And he said, well, here's two journals that you can try to submit to. If you have any other ideas, let me know. And I had like a very quick search around and decided that I didn't really know what I was looking for. And kind of just thought I'll just think about it when I get rejected from both these journals. That sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, it's that kind of, if you've got any ideas, come back to me step that we're going to talk about in our presentation today. As Simon mentioned, it's important for us to try to like help people listening to this to develop a strategy, because it does sound as though your journal selection was done a little bit ad hoc, Christine, based on what your supervisor had suggested, and maybe based upon the journals that they had previously published their work in. And now if you're listening to this, you can click through the short PowerPoint presentation that we've uploaded as part of this presentation today. And the first slide is about choosing a journal, because that really summarizes what we at Edance have seen when we've talked to researchers and worked with researchers, the kinds of things that people think about when they pick a journal, if they think about it at all. And we'll come back to that a little bit later on in our presentation. But really, this first slide can be boiled down into reach. Authors are interested in publishing in journals that have a decent reach within the community, a decent readership, maybe within their own community or within like the wider community within a subject or multidisciplinary. Reputation, so authors are interested in publishing their work in journals that have a decent reputation. And access, whether or not other people around the world are able to get access to the work that they are putting out there. And so, Simon, I wonder if from your experience at Cabell's, you'd have any comments on those kinds of things that, in your experience, researchers are looking at when they make a journal selection. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you could probably divide it into two parts, really. I think firstly, there are the traditional, more well-known aspects of the journal performance that they would consider, which is simply things like who else has published in the journal, who do they know, or you know, the kind of big names in their particular field who published. The impact factor, as Christine's mentioned, everybody talks about that. So there's those kind of mainstream aspects, but then there are lots of other data points out there that, and one of the kind of general points I'd like to make today is that, you know, there's a huge opportunity for any researcher to gather a large amount of data on which to base this decision from numerous different sources. So, for example, one of the data points that Cabell's has is that we ask the publishers of the journals to give us information on the time to publication, the time to acceptance, and also the, and this is one of the things that is often overlooked, the acceptance rate. Now, all things being equal, if you want to get published in a journal, then you would probably want to publish in a journal that has a higher acceptance rate, because in theory, at least, you'll have a higher chance of getting accepted. Now, there are sorts of nuances behind that. It's not necessarily the case, because if you, for example, submit a qualitative paper to a quantitative journal with a high acceptance rate, it's unlikely it's going to be accepted because it's not the type of article that that journal wants. But nevertheless, if you at least think that the journal is a good fit in terms of the aims and scope, then it makes sense that if there are two or three journals that you want to choose between, then why not send it to the journal that has the highest acceptance rate? So that's just one example of a data point that's out there that perhaps people don't realise you can access, that will definitely help you make a better decision when it comes to submitting your paper.
Great. Well, so I'm sure that people listening to this will be thinking, I mean, I know I'm thinking like back to my days as a PhD student and a postdoc, and I'm thinking like, I didn't really take any of these factors into account when selecting a journal. As Christine mentioned, like the main consideration for me was where my supervisor was publishing and where other people that I knew, like other contemporaries, other postdocs that I knew from different universities, where they were publishing their work. Christine, have you ever considered like acceptance rate or speed to publication? Would those be things that you'd be looking at, like maybe with your next paper? Because I know that you're currently working on a paper that you're looking for a journal to publish that paper in, right?
Yeah, I'm currently looking at different journals to publish in. I mean, to be honest, it never really occurred to me that an acceptance rate is something that you can check or that you should take into account. Like you said, it's always been all about what my supervisor recommends, because there's not just the fact that obviously it's so much easier to just go along with somebody who's more experienced. There's also this idea of, well, you're not going to start fighting your supervisor and being like, no, I know for a fact that this is this other journal and that's where I want to submit. So, yeah, I mean, I have to say that I think if you're somebody who, let's say, you don't have a supervisor be so involved in your publication process, I can see how, you know, it will be very challenging if you don't get some advice on how to do it. And it's actually really difficult to find something that's particularly kind of fits for your purpose, for your field, for your requirements, for your paper. It's actually not a straightforward process. And that's kind of why we have you and Simon here today, trying to simplify this and mentioning quite validly that there might be something such as an acceptance rate, which a lot of us probably haven't considered.
Yeah, I mean, there is kind of sometimes a bit of a disconnect between researchers, academics, and the information that the publishing industry can provide. So part of the reason that we're doing these events specifically targeted with researcher at young researchers is to provide that education that often, very often, is kind of lacking from PhD or postdoc training programs. So if you're looking at the slides and you're all signed up on Researcher App already, so you all do have accounts on Researcher App, and I'm sure Christine will talk a little bit more later about how Researcher can help you, how the app can help you to find journals that are publishing research in your field, and it's a great tool for doing that. But as you look at journals that come up on your feed, you should also probably be thinking, like, could I publish my next paper there? Could I put my next piece of work into that particular journal? And these kinds of metrics that we're going to provide you with, these tools, these ways of thinking about which journal to pick, we hope will provide people listening to this event with more of a roadmap for selecting their next journal. Now, it's often asked, this is one of the most common questions that we get in our workshops, which is again, like, why we decided we'd start with this particular topic. People ask us, like, how to pick a good journal. And the advice is often, have a look at where other colleagues are publishing. But let's move on from that a little bit. And I'm sure Simon's got a lot that he wants to talk about on this particular topic, because we, all of us, every day get emails. I know I do. I get 5 or 6 of them a week, inviting me to edit a special issue or publish a paper in an issue of a journal that may not be a particularly reputable journal. Simon, do you want to make some comments about what Cabells is doing to kind of help researchers and protect people from these, what we used to call predatory journals, predatory publishers, but I understand that we're not supposed to be using that term so much anymore. Simon?
Yeah, sure. So I've actually just finished the first draft of a book on predatory journals. So this is definitely my specialist subject. So I suppose the first myth to kind of blow out of the water, really, is that there's somehow a link between open access and predatory journals, in that open access is in some way a bad thing. A lot of researchers are slightly wary of open access journals because they think they are necessarily linked to predatory journals. Now, whilst it is true that the vast majority of predatory journals happen to be open access, the only reason why is because predatory publishers have taken the open access model and basically exploited it for their gain. And the reason they exploited it is that when open access journals started, which is the early 2000s, then all of a sudden authors who before that would never dream of paying to have their article published, then they were being asked to pay an article processing charge, or APC. Now, predatory publishers have taken advantage of that, of that particular model, and they are then, you know, send the emails, like you mentioned, Gareth, and they get people to publish in their journals purely to get that payment. Often the payment will be less than a reputable journal, and it has been extremely profitable for them. Some research that I did last year suggested that between $100 and $150 million a year is spent by authors on getting their articles published in predatory journals. Now, predatory journals, deceptive journals, fake journals, whatever you want to call them, they've taken advantage of the open access model. But whilst there are lots of predatory journals that are open access, there are also lots of open access journals that are incredibly good and high quality journals. So it's got nothing to do per se with open access. It's got everything to do with unscrupulous publishers and taking advantage of authors and the open access model. So when we owe quite a big debt to somebody called Jeffrey Beal, who in the late 2000s, around 2008, 2009, started publishing articles about predatory journals. It's he that coined that particular phrase. And he coined that phrase because he saw that these publishers were predating on authors and trying to kind of swindle the APCs out of them by presenting themselves as legitimate journals, but not doing anything that a legitimate journal would do. There was no peer review, there was no plagiarism checks, there was no proofreading, copy editing, there was no search engine optimization, all of the things that you would expect as part of the service with a regular, respectable journal. The predatory journals weren't doing any of that. And he was the first person to really highlight this, and he gained quite a lot of kind of fame and even notoriety as a result. And around 2015, my colleagues at Cabells decided that they wanted to kind of support his work but they didn't want to do what he was doing, which was he produced what people will know as Beale's List, which is quite a subjective list of publishers and journals, and some of which no doubt were predatory, some of which were probably not. And he got into a lot of problems because of the publishers who saw themselves as being identified unfairly as being predatory. And that ultimately led to the demise of Beale's List in early 2017. And completely by coincidence, when he pulled the plug on his list, we were already ready to launch with our predatory reports database. And we launched it in mid-2017. And what we wanted to do is create some verifiable criteria with which to judge whether a journal is predatory or not. And we have over 70 different criteria in three kind of levels of severity. And we only include journals if they have at least one of the most serious criteria against them. Usually it's something like they claim to be, for example, claim to have an impact factor when they don't, that kind of thing. And when we launched with 4,000 4.5 years ago, and as I said, now we've got over 15,000. And what we wanted to do is to create a resource so that all of those spam emails that Gareth mentioned, you're not tempted to publish in those journals that are sending you the emails. Very occasionally, you might receive an email if you signed up from a legitimate journal. But for the most part, those emails that you get are more than likely to be from predatory journals. It doesn't matter how good the email looks or how seemingly how well they seemingly know your research. You know, often they'll cite an article that you've written, for example. That's that just simply means that they're getting better at producing that kind of spam email. So hopefully what we're able to do is we make all the criteria that we have, for example, freely accessible. So anybody can go onto the website at Cabell's and Predatory Reports, and you can use those criteria for yourself alongside other criteria that people may have heard of, ThinkCheck Submit, and other a lot of libraries have really good websites to help their faculty members to not get lured into sending their articles to predatory journals.
Great stuff. I mean, we'll put all these resources in the chat for everybody as well. We'll provide all these resources in follow-up. Christine, do you want to comment on this topic? Have you gotten maybe some emails like inviting you to submit your PhD research to a journal that you're not sure about? And also, will you remind people when you've commented about how they can ask questions as well? I think that would be very good to do at this stage.
Thanks, Gareth. We'll give people the chance to speak in a bit. For now, if you'd like to submit a written question, you can go to slido.com in a separate browser window and use the code R1312 to submit a question to us. Just quick check, we don't currently have many questions, so please do ask using Slido. Onto your question. I did definitely get a few emails during my PhD to submit to predatory journals. I got this email pretty much instantly after I had my first publication out. I got this email and it was, "Dr. Bagdasarian, we have been so impressed with your publications and would you like to publish in our journal?" And I was thinking, wait a minute, I'm not a doctor yet. There's something fishy here. And I realized that this was probably not something that I should be taking seriously, basically. But I continued throughout my entire PhD. I just kept receiving these emails and they kept referring to me as Dr. Bagdasarian. One of the things that I really loved was how, so just a little background, my PhD is in plant biology. So I received this email multiple times asking me to publish in the American Journal of Transportation or something like that. And I was thinking, I understand that my publications have impressed you, but they don't seem to have anything that even remotely links to transportation. So I'm guessing that sometimes you just target it regardless of whether this is close to your field or not. You just happen to be a name on the list that gets picked up.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, sometimes it's quite easy to spot these emails. I got one at the beginning of the year that was signed by Agatha Christie, which was a bit of a a red flag for me. But so sometimes you can tell, and sometimes these publishers are just, you know, fishing for authors. But studies have shown, as I'm sure Simon will comment as well, that lots of people and lots of reputable academics working at big institutions quite often end up putting their work by mistake into these kinds of journals, paying the article processing charge, and then the work doesn't get properly peer reviewed, the work doesn't get properly published, and then of course you can't retract the work and publish it somewhere else. It's been published in inverted commas, so you may end up spending quite a lot of money for what is at the end of the day not such a great publication. There's a number of ways you can immediately have a think about this. Think, Check, Submit is one great website to go to. Edance Learning Lab also has a journal selector. You'll see a screenshot from that if you have a look at the slide deck that we've put together. And Simon also mentioned the Cabell's databases that are well worth having a look at, sharing with your colleagues, and maybe having a chat about this kind of thing. If you have a journal club or you have a discussion group within your PhD research group or within your department, these are key issues to have a think about. And I remember from my own academic career, as we've talked about several times, this was not really something that we spent a great deal of time thinking about at all. We just looked at where other people in the field were publishing their work. But if you get one of these emails, who's it coming from? Can you find the journal website? Does the journal website look reputable? And often, as I'm sure Simon will also note in a moment, these websites of predatory publishers can look very good and can look very reputable. But go in and have a look at what they've been publishing. What kinds of papers have recently appeared? Who's on the editorial board? Can you recognize any of the names of other academics on that editorial board? Because another thing that these journals often do is they put people on their editorial boards that are, you know, without asking, without checking first, and they'll tell you that they have impact factors. We'll talk about impact factors, I'm sure, in a minute, because that's one of the key metrics that researchers are interested in when they pick a journal. But, you know, what kind of impact factor? Is it really a real impact factor? Simon, do you want to jump in on any of those topics?
Yeah, well, just on the impact factor. So firstly, you know, anybody, it used to be that you, it was actually a little bit more difficult to check whether a journal had an impact factor or not, because the impact factor, a lot of the data was behind a paywall, and there is something called the journal master list. So let's go back to the start. So the impact factor is a score that is given to journals that are indexed by a company called Clarivate Analytics, and Clarivate Analytics have an index that's called the Web of Science, and every journal that is indexed on the Web of Science has an impact factor, and currently there are about 13,000 journals across all disciplines that have that impact factor. Now, the journal master list just used to be a simple list of all the journals that had an impact factor. Actually, now you can get a little bit more information. So if you look at journal master list on the Clarivate website, not only does it tell you the journals that have an impact factor, it gives you last year's impact factor. So it doesn't give you the current impact factor, but it does give you last year's impact factor. And any journal that has been taken off there, for example, then you wouldn't see that. So the actual list of journals is very much up to date, but the data, they give you data that's a year old. There's obviously an incentive for you to, if you wanted the latest data, then you can try and persuade your library to subscribe. So the impact factor is extremely verifiable. And there are no other impact factors. There are no other factors. There are no other legitimate journal metrics that either have the word impact or factor in it. There's only one impact factor. So if any journal says it has an impact factor, then you can very easily check, look at the journal master list on the Clarivate Analytics website, and that will tell you if that journal has an impact factor or not, and it will give you a last year's impact factor if it does. So it's things like that are, you know, I would estimate that about a third to 40% of the journals that we have on predatory reports claim to have an impact factor or something similar. But there's, like I said, there's nothing similar. There's only one impact factor, and you can easily check that for free. So that's a simple step that you can take to verify whether the journal has got an impact factor or not.
We need to put we'll put these pieces of information out there for everybody to have a look at. So, I mean, did you ever go through this kind of process, Christine? Did you ever like think about checking impact factors or verifying impact factors? I mean, maybe you will now that you're picking a journal for your next paper, right?
What do you now think? That I've gained all these skills from this webinar, I sure as hell I'm going to check the impact factor, right?
And does Researcher App have any information on these kinds of metrics at all?
I don't think so, but we do kind of help you choose the right journals for your publication using our journal finder. So I think that's the second slide on the PDF.
Right.
So if you go to the author tools and researcher, you can find, you can put in a piece of your abstract, and it will help you using language recognition technology. It will help you find suitable journal for your research. Just to add quickly, if you have problems with it not finding anything, just try and shorten your piece of writing that you've put in. Sometimes that can happen. Anyway, so in terms of impact factor and whether I've had experience with it, when I got my first publication and I had a lot of people telling me, oh, wow, you know, this is published in a really good journal, the Journal of Development, in case anybody's familiar with it. And I was thinking, great. And then I looked up the impact factor and it was something like 6.8. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, Nature's impact factor is what, like 49? And suddenly this kind of six, it looked like a baby figure. I thought I was like, maybe people are lying to me. Maybe this whole time they've been telling me that this is really good, but actually it's not that good at all. I remember just being so confused, like, what is considered a good impact factor? How do you know? And I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with because you have journals like Nature, like I said, that are in the double digits. And, you know, I definitely wasn't on the double digits with my publications.
So I think we need to go back to Simon on that. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, Simon, but we're going to, like, so what is a good impact factor? Like, what does that mean, at least from Cabell's perspective?
Well, I mean, from anybody's perspective, it depends, unfortunately. So just quickly, the way that the impact factor is calculated is that the impact factor looks at 2 years worth of publications for a single journal. And then in the third year, it looks at the number of times that journal has been cited in all the other journals indexed by that particular, by Web of Science. So, for example, if over a two-year period a journal publishes 60 articles, and in the following year those 60 articles are cited 60 times in various journals that are also indexed in Web of Science, then the impact factor will be 1, because you simply divide the number of publications in 2 years by the number of citations in the following year. Now, these can really vary massively. So in social sciences, an impact factor of 6 would be huge. Like, that would be probably top of whatever social science discipline. So if you were in economics, geography, politics, those kinds of topics, then there's very few journals that will have an impact factor as high as that. But if you're in, for example, medical science, then actually there are, that would be very particularly low, because they have much greater what we call churn. There are many, many more articles being published, and there are many, many of those articles that are being cited because it's a particularly kind of vibrant year, vibrant area. So, for example, the journal with the highest impact factor currently is a journal called A Cancer Journal for Clinicians. Now, this journal is almost set up to provide the highest impact factor because it only publishes 20 articles per year, which is the minimum number of articles that Web of Science will index a journal for. If you publish 15 articles a year, then you won't get indexed in Web of Science. So it's a minimum of 20. Now, journals, for example, like Nature, will publish many hundreds. Other journals like Public Library of Science or Scientific Reports will actually publish tens of thousands of articles a year. They're absolutely huge. But Cancer Journal for Clinicians only publishes 20, but it is enormously cited. And its impact factor this year, I believe, is over 400. And it's the journal with the highest impact factor.
Good grief, 400.
It's cited. Those 20 articles are the very, 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 very most important articles in one of the biggest fields. And they've been cited something like 18,000 times. Anyway, if you do the math, you get an enormous impact factor. Now, I've just been explaining the context there. So Christine's right. If you just see a figure that says 6.7 or whatever it is, that doesn't really sound particularly impressive. But in plant biology, for example, then that may well be, I suspect, will be probably reasonably good. There'll be lots of journals like, say, Nature will have a higher impact factor. But a journal like Scientific Reports, which last year published over 25,000 articles, its impact factor, I think, is only 4. And that's simply because of the way the impact factor is calculated. If you publish 20,000 articles, not all of those are going to get cited. So that tends to dilute the impact factor. So it's really important that that researchers equip themselves with this kind of contextual information and not simply take the score, such as the impact factor, at face value.
Yeah, we used to see this in our department, like, because you may encounter this, like, when you talk to other colleagues, like, working in your university, and they're talking about where they've just published a paper and about the impact factor of that journal. And as Simon's just said, it's incredibly field dependent. In my area in paleontology, like, the impact factors of journals specific to that discipline are quite low, like 1 to 2, probably around that range. And that's why we recommend, if you're working in an area that, you know, gives you the possibility of publishing more multidisciplinary articles, then try to aim, as we were taught in our discipline, to try to publish in biology journals where more people are going to get the chance to read your work. So if you can get your paper into Proceedings of the Royal Society, for example, rather than Journal of Paleontology, then you're going to be able to get access to a journal that may have a slightly higher impact factor. We're going to throw it open in a moment, Christine, right, to see if any of our participants have questions or comments on anything that we've talked about before. I think we will need to go back maybe just quickly, Simon, and just give people some definitions potentially for some of the things that we've talked about, like an open access journal. That's a journal where everything or some of the content is published in an open way that anyone can get access to, often by authors having to pay an article processing charge, as Simon's mentioned, as opposed to the traditional quote unquote model for academic publishing. That's where you used to go along to the library and pick up journals off the shelf, and, you know, only if your institution or your research group or even your country in some cases had bought a subscription to those journals would you actually have access to that content. So from a researcher's perspective, publishing in a traditional journal, that's most often cost-free, whereas choosing to publish your work in an open access journal often incurs a cost to the researcher or to the research group. Christine, what do you think? Should we see if we have any comments or any questions on topics that we've covered so far?
Yeah, we already have some questions, so it will be nice to address them. But I do want to ask something. I hope you can answer me that specific question. So basically, like we talked, it's so different from field to field. And I feel that this is well, how should a person who's just starting their career, how should they know what the relative impact factor is? I think that's quite a challenging prospect. I mean, people say like the higher the impact factor is, the better, but then you might be setting yourself for unrealistic expectations. Like you said, in your field, one or two was the common impact factor for the journals that you could publish in, and you'd have to aim for another field to get that impact factor. So are there other tools that might be a little more, maybe more objective in certain way, that something that doesn't depend so much on your field, or is that just the best we've got?
Simon?
So one thing that I always advise researchers to do is to, and this sounds a little bit trite, but I always say research your research. So if you're, for example, if you're going to, you're putting together your CV and you're applying for a job, then you would always research the company that you want to work for or the university that you want to apply to. And in the same way, you know, you have to think about, because like your CV, your academic publishing record will be with you forever, your entire career. And if you make one mistake, then that's going to, it's always going to be on that, on your record. So I would always kind of, you know, use the research skills that have enabled you to get a PhD, that have enabled you to get, potentially get published. You know, your, anybody who is engaged with academic research is an excellent investigator, and they need to use those skills to investigate things like impact factors and journals, etc. And it's quite frankly almost, it's extremely remiss of anybody to not do that, because the risk that you're taking with your own career is potentially huge. So the first thing I would say is that if you start to look at the publishing kind of world, then it's good to put that, the impact factor, in context. So like I said, the impact factor is Clarivate would like to say that it's the creme de la creme of journals. It's the very best journals in every single field, which is by and large, that's more or less true. They've only got 13,000 journals. There are at least 100,000 journals currently being published at this time. If you look at both predatory journals or so-called kind of grey journals, which are probably, they're not predatory, but they're not very good. If you look at other index journals, so for example, the other major journals index is called Scopus, which is owned by Elsevier, the world's biggest publisher. Scopus currently has 36,000 journals indexed across all disciplines. So it's three times nearly bigger than the Web of Science. And so there's a huge number of journals there that are, they go through a quality check. It's not as hard to get your journal accepted into Scopus than it is into the Web of Science, but it is, nevertheless, there are minimum quality criteria that your journal has to meet. And all the journals in Scopus also, they have something called the Cite Score, which is a similar metric to the impact factor. There are actually other metrics available. There's at least two other metrics available, which kind of give you a different flavor of the potential academic impact of that particular journal. So, and again, this information is freely available. So in order to understand, you know, where you as a researcher, where you kind of sit in all of this, it's really important to kind of take a step back and say, okay, well, there's at least 100,000 journals that are out there. I need to get as much information together and to kind of create a long list using all of this available information to try to understand what the best journal is for my particular research in my particular stage of career. So I think that really is important. And I think it is the responsibility of the individual researcher in order to do that, because at the end of the day, the researcher is going to benefit if they make a good decision and publish in a good journal, but they also may suffer if they make a bad decision. This may be a little bit controversial. I understand there's politics involved, but I would not go with what my supervisor told me at all. I would definitely take on board what they said, but I would want to actually have verifiable information in order to base the decision on where I want to publish.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking I wish I'd known a lot of this information when I was when I was working as an academic, because I must say, I don't want to talk too much because I know we've got some hands up and there's lots of questions coming in. But yeah, as you said, Simon, like, people can make themselves much more informed, but often there's politics involved. You're working with a supervisor, you're working in a research group. It may, even though it's your research, it may not be your decision at the end of the day which journal the work is going to go to. Christine, shall we have a look at some questions? I can see there's a few hands up in the group down below.
Yeah, so I was thinking we could go through the Slido first and then let people speak after that, if that's okay. Sure. With Gareth.
Of course, yeah. I mean, we're lucky that Simon's here with us today, so let's have a look at what questions we have in the Slido, and then do you want to read some out, Christine?
Yeah, one second. So we have one question. I think that's related to kind of the predatory journal topic that we covered. And it's asking, are there concerns with also presenting research work at conferences for fee?
Who? Presenting research work at conferences for a fee? Yes, well, there's lots of predatory conferences as well. And I think that Think Check Submit have a conference version of their website, right, Simon, where people can have a look at what conferences are reputable and what conferences are potentially not.
Yeah, it's called Think Check Attend.
Okay.
And yeah, absolutely. You're, and what we've actually seen in the last couple of years is as a result of the pandemic, is that the publisher, the predatory conference providers, who are often linked to the predatory publishers, they're very much the same people. They've pivoted, and potentially this pivot could be quite lucrative for them. So their business model for a conference was that they would try and get a relatively low number of people to a room in a hotel, and even if they only had kind of 10 or 20 people, then the people there, they would get the certificate, they would get everything they would need to kind of tick the box to show that they've been to an academic conference and presented their paper. And they would actually present a paper. But, you know, you would have, for example, a paleontologist sat next to a plant biologist sat next to a philosopher. And there wasn't much in the way of, obviously, you know, the sort of conference that we've grown to kind of recognize as an academic conference. Now, what the predatory publishers realized, obviously, was that with the lockdowns, then that model couldn't happen, because you can't tempt people to go to some kind of foreign climes in order to present their paper on the, you know, on a kind of hotel next to the beach in Waikiki or whatever it is, because there was no travel. So what they did was that they started to do it online, and they would charge a much lower fee but get more people. So instead of paying a fee of, say, $500 for 10 or 20 people, they could charge a fee of $50 for 1 or 200 people. And they would have none of the overheads that they would incur by renting a room in a hotel. So I kind of saw this firsthand, because one of my former somebody that I was kind of in touch with when I was in publishing as an editor, that I saw just by a coincidence that they had been invited and were speaking at a predatory conference as their plenary, and so I warned him about it. But what they'd done is that they'd accepted this because it was an online event and it was kind of easy for them to do. They were based in Florida. It was easy for them to just go online and deliver the plenary. But they didn't realize that it was a predatory conference, and the people that were attending there were, whilst it was a low entrance fee, it wasn't really a proper conference. So they've kind of pivoted so that they're able to present themselves as potentially even more legitimate looking by going online and asking people to pay a small fee in order to present online at the conference. And it's even more difficult as a result to understand, you know, once you're actually in the conference, that what you're presenting at is predatory.
Fascinating. Wow. The lengths people will go to make money. Christine, do we have any more questions?
So we have one asking specifically if 14% acceptance rate is normal. I don't know if you can tell us anything about that, Simon.
14, 14.
Yeah.
Well, Again, it depends, but 14% acceptance rate is relatively low, which indicates a relatively kind of healthy, good quality journal. There's a huge difference. There are, you know, for example, so Scientific Reports, which I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons it publishes over 20,000 articles a year is that it doesn't really reject very many. it has a very, very low kind of minimum level of quality. So basically, as long as the science is sound, it will publish the article. And that's part of it. You know, it's very open about that. That's part of its kind of unique selling point. So, but there, I mean, famously, there's a journal called the Harvard Business Review that some people might know. It has an acceptance rate of less than 1%. Hardly anything gets published in there. So, and you know, you have to be very careful with this kind of information. All that tells you is that, all things being equal, it's more difficult to get published in Harvard Business Review than get published in Scientific Reports, but they're completely different journals and completely different aims and scope and quality profile. So again, it's useful to have that one piece of information. So if a journal is only accepting 14% of the articles, so that means it's rejecting 6 in 7 of all submissions, you would like to think that it's quite a good quality journal. And if it's publishing a lot of articles per year, that means it's got a very healthy submission rate and people really, you know, really want to try and get published in that, even though it's relatively hard to get published in. So all things being considered, that is probably a good sign if an acceptance rate is only 14%.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm just gonna read out the next question. So this one is, can you publish a paper you have used for a class or a master thesis?
You can, but you need to check carefully, like about the rules. And that would be something that you'd probably need to flag to the target journal. So, I mean, if you've previously published some content in a master's thesis or in a PhD thesis, that definitely needs to be cited and flagged to the journal that you intend to target. So,
just another question that I think is kind of linked to that is asking a very similar question. Would you recommend publishing your overall dissertation as open access?
Oh, that's a great question. And that again would depend upon your subject area, but I mean, it depends what you want to achieve with your publication, I would say. I mean, some people in some fields do want to get their entire dissertation published in one volume. And if I was publishing something, of course, I would prefer that it was open access, but cost could be a big factor in that. So I'm not sure I would recommend that you do that, but I mean, it could be something to consider. Simon, what do you think?
Yeah, because if we're talking about an open access manuscript, firstly you need to check what the policy is of your institution. So a lot of institutions will make PhD theses available anyway, so you should just check that out first. Secondly, the cost of publishing essentially a book, an open access book, as a PhD thesis would be around, in euros, you would be talking about 10,000 euros, give or take. It can be very, very expensive. And usually that option is taken by people who've got who've got a lot of research money behind them, who are able to use some of that research funding to pay for an open access book. So that there's a number of different considerations behind that. But my first thing would be to just check whether your institution is actually makes the theses available or not.
Just another question that I'm going to address is just asking whether we're going to provide any materials. I'm going to add the slides of the presentation to the description of this event within maybe an hour tops of the end of this event. and anything else that Gareth or Simon send my way, I will add to the description of this event. So basically, after this is finished, it will automatically become a Listen Now link. So it will be the same event that you guys remember and have joined. It will just be a podcast, so you can come back, listen to this talk in case you forget any of the information, and I will be adding the helpful resources in the description, so you'll be able to find to access the PDF and anything
else. Put yourself to sleep later if you want to listen back again. what about some hands? We have a few hands up, I can see. Should we quickly invite some people to join us for the last few minutes?
So I'm just going to make each one of you a speaker and you can ask a question. Okay, hi. Do you mind unmuting yourself using the three dots on your avatar and asking a question, please? You have to click on the three dots and choose unmute if you want to ask your question. I'll just give you a few more moments to work that out.
Hi, Charlene. Do you want to ask a question? Christine has promoted you to speaker area, so you can unmute yourself if you'd like to have a go.
Okay, yeah. So sometimes people press the raise hand button by accident, so I'll just make you a listener for now. And if you do have a question, oh, there we go.
Yeah, what was the rule for us to choose the journal, which I'm interested in? Do you have any software to help people to choose journal?
Absolutely, yes. Well, there's the Researcher app has a journal selector tool, Edance has a journal selector tool, and Cabell's has a series of databases that you can use to select a journal. So it's a great question, and that's really the reason that we put together this panel for this particular opening event of the series, because all three of us represent organizations that are perfectly positioned to help you pick a journal. So, yeah, great question.
Yeah, but is anything you can talk about how to pick up a journal? For example, what was the basic rule, like based on the impact factor, or what do you think about impact factor related to your study? How these two things get together?
You want to go for that one, Simon?
So I suppose one thing we haven't talked about with the impact factor is that in recent years, there's been a bit of a backlash against the impact factor and against the use of a single journal metric to decide whether that journal is good quality or not. So there's something called the San Francisco Declaration, or DORA. And what DORA says is that it's a growing number of publishers and universities have signed up to DORA. And DORA basically says that you shouldn't use the impact factor on its own. And if you are going to judge the performance of an academic or performance of an article or the performance of a journal, then you need to kind of take a wide range of measures and understand the context. And try to be as qualitative as well as being quantitative. So in other words, understanding a bit more about the journals aside from just pure statistics. So I think the impact factor is, by and large, I talked about research. If you look at, there's a huge amount of academic literature on the impact factor, mostly by statisticians who really hate it, because statistically, there are a lot of problems with the impact factor. It is not an accurate representation of the quality of a journal. That's not to say it's necessarily inaccurate. What it is that if you understand the calculation involved, then it will give you a rough idea as to whether the journal is well cited or not, but you have to look at where those citations take place.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you for your question. I'll just make you a listener again, and next person. Kieran, would you mind unmuting yourself and asking your question, please?
Yeah, hi, is that working?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh yeah, so I've just got a question about open access. I was actually lucky enough to actually have some work of mine published recently, although it was work that I actually conducted 7 or 8 years ago for my my master's thesis. It took a long time to get the thing published because I submitted to a couple of different journals and they rejected it and stuff, and I had to, you know, do several redrafts, and I eventually did settle on a journal that was willing to accept it. But what was surprising is that they actually offered me open access completely free of charge. I'm just wondering, is that something you should be wary of in future, if a journal just so brazenly offers you to have your article available open access without charging you anything?
Simple answer is no. So I think Gareth mentioned earlier, in terms of one of the sources of information that's particularly useful with regard to open access is something called the DOAJ, or the Directory of Open Access Research. Directory of Open Access Journals. It's a list of about 12 or 13,000 open access journals, and again, it's an index. So those journals have been chosen because they meet certain minimum criteria. Now, I believe that the majority of journals that are on DOAJ are actually are free to publish in. And this is called it's either called platinum or diamond open access.
Yeah.
The reason that it's free to publish in is because there is a sponsor or a university or something like that behind the journal who is willing to cover the cost of publication in order to enable that journal to be open access and not to have to charge the authors an APC.
So
it's not, you know, they're not, you don't need to be wary about it. I know it's that kind of general rule that if it's too good to be true, it probably is. But in that case, it's not. For example, in Predator Reports, we've got hardly any journals that don't ask for some kind of payment. Mm. Now, plenty of legitimate journals do ask for payment. It's just a kind of bonus if you happen to be able to find a good quality journal that doesn't ask for any kind of payment.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. I'll just make a listener now. Now I'm going to make Shalapi, I think, a speaker. If you can please unmute yourself and ask your question, we'll try and answer. If you just press the three dots on your avatar and select unmute.
Hello.
Oh, great. Yes, we can hear you. Yeah, hello.
Hello, how are you? Quick question. My first publication is already done, but we have, by mistake, something in affiliation. My affiliation is, so my supervisors tried to contact with the journal and publisher. The journal is Planta and the publisher is Brain Nature. And after that, we got the correction after 2 weeks. But the correction is not in the whole PDF. The correction is updated as an updated PDF on website, not in all PDF. So my question is, if the update of my affiliation is going to be inside my PDF, my paper, or it will be going an updated issue for this publication. Okay, this is my first question. My second question, I have a paper I tried to submit it and I tried to publish from 2 years, and until now, I didn't get a good result for it, I ask what the correction will be going on my first publication.
Have you been waiting for 3 years for your paper to get accepted, just to answer the second question, or have you been continually submitting it and it's been rejected a number of different places?
I have two paper. One paper is I tried to submit it from 2 years and until now I didn't success. The second paper is already published by Heather, but by mistake, my affiliation is not right.
Okay.
is substituted from 1 to 2, but my affiliation, and is going corrected by the journal, but is not inside the correction updated on the website, you know? If you go into the paper, if you're going to paper, you will find the same affiliation is not corrected. But if you're going online, you will find an updated issue for this for this publication. And the PDF, this PDF is figure out this man have affiliation, blah 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 blah, and he's right, it my affiliation is right. So I ask like if the journal in the future is going to submit to correct affiliation in the right way on the PDF or not, or it can't.
They will update. They should update. I think you just need to send an email to the editor or to the production team and remind them that they need to make that change on the PDF that's on the website. So I think that's what you need to do in that situation.
My supervisor is connected, but and to try to send them a lot of emails, but the correction is going as an updated file, you know.
I'm very sorry that you've had issues with your editor, and I really hope that it gets resolved quickly. It sounds like this is something that you will just have to pick up with the journal and the editors of the journal, and it will get resolved over time. Just needs a little bit of patience. If that's okay by you, I'd love to move on to other people asking their questions. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
I think you were the next person who raised their hand, if you'd like to speak. Just have to press unmute on your avatar.
Hello?
Hi.
Okay, do you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, good. Nice. Thanks, Christine. Thank you for allowing me to have a question. I just make it quick. I listened to the conversation and discussion with Mr. Gareth and Simon and Christine as well. The question is, how do we know that our writing meets the expectation from the journals that we wish to target? Because I linked that to the aims and scope, publication speed, and acceptance rate. Typically, we try to fulfill their requirements, and then we find the journal, okay, now this is the journal. But then how do we know that the writing meet the expectation from the journal? Thank you.
One thing you can do is you can try to send a pre-submission inquiry to the editor before you write and submit your article. That's a good strategy to be sure that your particular piece of work, that your particular article is going to be a good match for that journal. So that's one strategy that we do recommend, that, you know, rather than just making blind submissions to journals, it's a good idea to send an email. And I can give you a template if you get in touch with me afterwards to write to the editor and ask them, is this particular topic suitable for submission to this particular journal? I hope that helps. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry.
Yes, certainly. Thank you, Mr. Gareth. I'm going to contact you through email after this.
Okay. I'm just going to make the next person a speaker, if that's okay.
Sure. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
We have time for like just one or two more, right, Christine?
I would say. Yeah. I think if we can just let the last two people ask their questions and then wrap up. Vinay, if you would like, yeah.
Yes, I'll go now. Many thanks for organizing this event, firstly. It's been extremely helpful. I just want to know, just to build on from the preceding question, whether it's feasible, in case you have a compelling argument and a strong enough data set, and I'm speaking from the point of view of a highly qualitative field like anthropology, sociocultural anthropology. But if you're submitting to a leading journal in another academic context, particularly in the global north, is there a chance, in case your empirical context or empirical worldview comes from a country in the global south, whether that paper would be considered, all else being constant? Thank you.
Oh, that's a great question, Simon. I don't know if you want to say something about or comment on that.
I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of literature out there which shows that there is bias in so-called global North journals against global South authors. In other words, the propensity for a global South author to be published in a global North journal is a lot less than for a global North author. And one aspect of that is that, I mean, to go back to the impact factor, for example, one of the reasons why people don't like it is because the impact factor was created a long time ago. It's actually over 50 years ago. And it was created by essentially a bunch of white chemists in North America who wanted to know what the best chemistry journal was. So they looked at citations, but at that stage, the most cited chemistry journals were the American Journal of Chemistry, the Journal of American Chemistry, you know, that kind of thing. It was, and that's where it started. And it kind of grew from that very much kind of North American base. And it grew from the type of research published in those journals, which was obviously against other forms. I mean, North American stroke Northern European research paradigms tend to be quantitative, positivist. You know, there's a certain type of research published, and it's being published by authors who are either first English as a first language, or have been, you know, brought up in a university system where English is incredibly rich. So there's always been a bias in those top ranked journals against global South authors, because that's how everything, you know, developed, and it was perpetuated by things like the impact factor. Having said that, like I said, this is one of the reasons why you've got initiatives like DORA, which are trying to kind of remove the power structure that exists with the impact factor in those journals. And also there's one particular project I'm involved in at the moment, which is around the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. Now, there's a huge amount of funding going into SDG research. And what's interesting is that SDG research tends to focus on countries, for example, developing countries or global South countries. The reason is because, you know, the way that the SDGs are constructed, it shows that there's a greater need to kind of achieve the goals that are required to halt climate change, etc. The countries that are worst affected tend to be the global South countries. But so where we had a paradigm previously, which was kind of a self-perpetuating paradigm, which only said, okay, well, these are the quality journals, these are only the quality journals, and it's this type of research which is recognized as quality. We're now seeing that that change to the value of research being on what kind of real world impact it has. That's where funding is going to, that's where publishers are increasingly wanting to publish articles that have that kind of real world impact. And the project I'm involved in is trying to create a metric which will help people understand the extent to which journals and articles have that real world impact, rather than the traditional metric of pure citations. So I think that unfortunately it's not going to change any, you know, quickly, but I do think that things are shifting away from, you know, North American, Northern European research being the be all and end all of everything, towards a much more kind of democratic, if you like, way of assessing research, and understanding that the value of research is not necessarily in how many citations it has, but in whether it's actually changed something.
Okay, so do you guys think that we have time for one more question before we wrap up?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Lee, I think you've had your hand up for a while. So if you can please unmute yourself and ask your question, that would be great.